Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies and promoting our speaker's book, I Object. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference, brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremedyisinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide Communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social a network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions and all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Everett for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not that your remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy Is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I thank you for the disclaimer that you've given to us. It's important. I think it's something that has kept my position out of a witness chair, being charged with practicing law without a license. Anyways, the thing is that it's good to have this disclaimer for everyone to understand. Tonight, we're going to be enjoying the words of Herr Slevin. With regards to the turnkey LLC that enables entrepreneurs as well as employees operate in such a fashion as to where they have minimized to zero their tax liabilities. Let me preface this, please, with something that Justice Beshear offers in regards to what he calls the golden horseshoe. The cost of the golden horseshoe from beginning to end is like $35,000. It requires a corporation sole, private interest foundations, three foreign grantor trusts, and then to the LLC, all of them crafted to work in unison to where all of the tax liability has been totally stripped. $35,000 is a big chunk of change. Bernie's been doing this for almost 30 years, offering this, and not one of his students have ever had a problem with the IRS with that regards. But again, $35,000 is a big chunk of change. On the other hand, what Herr Slevin offers is $7,500. And I would plead with you to add two charitable religious trusts on top of that to be $9,500, a far, far cry from the $35,000 it takes to set up for the same results. The purpose for Herr Slevin's process is to give anyone immediate access to enable them to properly arrange their affairs. Construct, if you would, the arrangement of the organization through an LLC that strips the taxes away. Then, when it becomes affordable, you can take the two charitable religious trusts that have been designed to be replaced by the two foreign grantor trusts of the three foreign grantor trusts that are included in the Golden Horseshoe, and you have now doubled, if you would, your zero tax liability footprint. I'm a firm believer in overkill. You can't bring enough weaponry to a firefight. So to that end, it's my pleasure to introduce Herr Slevin. Bring him forward. and invite him to share what his plans are on how he can assist you with this and how it works out that we're here to support you all the way through from step one to the last step involved and any places in between. Herr Slevin?
Good evening.
Good evening to you, sir.
I thought they would start with a little thing from the home country. My family does rain from... Excuse me?
Transylvania? You're coming off of this Dracula accent. Go ahead.
That happens to be correct. The reason I wanted to bring that forward is because some fellow people of your beautiful country of America is now in our neighboring province. The 101st Airborne Division has been committed to our beautiful Romania. I understand they're training and doing all sorts of army things upon a continent, upon the province not 3 miles from our border with the Ukraine, and their unfortunate discussions with the Russians. Alas, we will have to endure, just hoping that some idiot doesn't fire some type of nuclear bomb. So, good evening, folks. A little bit about some history. A little bit about some history here. Can you still hear me good?
Yeah, hear you well. Hear you
okay,
well.
Great.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the organic document of the United States of America, the country, which is a union of several independent countries, was done on July 4th, 1776. It is the Declaration of Independence, in which we, the people, decided that we were going to tell the King of England and his minions and cohorts to go pound sand. And so I encourage you highly to go back and read the Declaration of Independence. It's a marvelous, marvelous document. And a very succinct categorization of the oppressive nature that the King of England, at that time was King George. Of course, we now have King Charles III, and they were both thirds. Anyway, the king and his minions had foisted upon what they considered to be a second-class citizen known as the colonists. And which the colonists felt that they were free men, free Englishmen, if you will. And so it reached an impasse, and Mr. Jefferson was very eloquent about doing that. But that set up a walking away in the public eye from everything. Unfortunately, it wasn't decisive enough because there were several underlying contracts still involved with the Queen of England, or the King of England at that time. But up until recently, the Queen was, because she reigned for so flipping long. Anyway, there's the Queen's Highway up in Maryland and New Jersey. There's all kinds of backdoor deals that were done by, and we'll use the term City of London, in that escapade, if you will. So we have that situation in 1776, and then of course the war that took place and the founding of the Army and the Navy via congressional fiat, then let me get something up here on this little screen. And so the organization that the Union fell under then was known as the Articles of Confederation, which was our first attempt at having a unified government to face and to dispense with this war between us and the city of London, for lack of a better term. And so that didn't work out too well because it really didn't give enough power to the unified to the central government. So December 15th, 1791, the Constitution, 1787, the Constitution was put together, and it more properly spelled out the role of the federal government. And we call it federal because it is a compact between the several United Nations, the several nations that the former colonies all became independent nations and decided to join in this union, this federal situation. That the Constitution is well done, and it has some people considered lacking. And so on December 15, 1791, the Bill of Rights was ratified. Now, here again, it should really be called the Bill of Restrictions, because if you go and look at it, that's exactly what it says. It's we the people talking to these folks that are now as part of the federal government and saying, you are to do these things, but you are not to do this thing. Like, you shall not infringe upon the right to keep and bear arms. I don't know if you know what infringe means, but if you look at the militarized American flag with a gold fringe around it, it's a bunch of small gold threads, and there's a whole bunch of them, several thousand, in a standard flag size. So the word infringe was meant, and is today still, means that you, the government, shall not take one tiny thread from that gold fringe, that right for we the people to keep and bear arms. And look that up sometime. It's got some fascinating connotations to it. And when the man sitting in the White House, well, I think he's a man, sitting in the White House right now says, well, you just weren't able to buy cannons. Anybody couldn't buy a cannon. Oh, that's totally wrong. All the cannons at Bunker Hill and Breed Hill were personally owned cannons. So he's lying again. Nonetheless, so we have the federal government. At that time, they were ensconced between Philadelphia and New York, depending on which one was being raided at the time by the British. And so soon after that, the states of Maryland and Pennsylvania and one other, I think. Anyway, they handed forth Virginia. They handed forth what is now called the District of Columbia. And that is a 10 mile square parcel of land allotted to the United States. So when the Constitution for the United States was written back in 1787, then it says, and go back and read this. It says this is for prosperity and justice and everything. We commissioned this Constitution for the United States of America. So upon getting their own parcel, the federal government, otherwise known as the United States, was situated, and that came about strictly about the District of Columbia Organic Act of 1871. And they adopted the Constitution, but they changed one little word. It says this is the Constitution of the United States. World of difference. Definitions matter. And so you can look up the difference between for and of. So in 1871, the individual charters of the city of Washington and Georgetown were eradicated, and the new government territory was known as the whole District of Columbia. It's sometimes still referred to as Washington City. Upon that act, and here again, some say that it became a corporation, and some verification for that is found today in 28 U.S.C. 302 definitions and it says as used in this chapter, United States means a federal corporation. What this did on the world stage was it put it as a city-state, as the same as the City of London, which is a one-square-mile area enclave within Greater London, UK. And the Vatican City, which is approximately the same size in the city known as Rome. So now we have these three powers that are the three controlling spheres of the earth. And how do we know that District of Columbia or DC, for example, became a world power? Because it started acquiring property. In 1898, it stole Hawaii from the queen of that arena. Also in 1898, it acquired Cuba, Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines from King Ferdinand of Spain. It became a ruler of those pieces of property. Of course, there was much ado about now that the people living on those particular pieces of dirt were now, you know, under the protection of the United States. Since then, Cuba was granted independence, and which was probably a mistake, and because now they still suffer under the Fidel Revolution of the 1950s. So then Guam is still totally controlled by America, and then Puerto Rico, and then the Philippines they actually paid the King of Spain for the Philippines roughly $20 million. In 1898, of course, that was a great deal of money. And then the Philippines has since became its own country and its own ruling. And if you've watched any news in the past 40 years, you know how that turned out. So that's a little background behind and verification, if you will, of why we must look at D.C. as a city-state. And the fact that the federal government resides there and would be intent upon infringing upon the rights of we the people. This has been done absolutely by design, via backdoor deals, via edicts where they didn't really have the power. They just took the power, and there was nobody to figure out what, who, how the heck are you ruling over me or whatever. So that's the situation we find ourselves in. And I would suggest that you go and research the Trading with the Enemies Act of 1917 and how it was now Title 50 of the United States Code, and then how that was invoked in 1933 by our glorious leader at the time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or FDR, and the subsequent demonization of we the people. And then, of course, the Social Security Act of 1935, where they built financial contracts that if one decided that they were a, quote, qualified individual, end quote, they could then partake of this marvelous retirement system. But then that also turned into a tax identification number. And the effort of signing a 1040 United States income tax return in the federal judiciary eyes makes one liable for the income tax for life. Or they accept the liability of the income tax for life. It's all a lot of smoke and mirrors, folks, but it's written down. And as we used to say in the military, if it ain't written down, it didn't happen. So the fact that they got it written down puts it in it. Now, how did they write it? Well, they use these people called the lexicographers. Lexicographer is a wordsmith of the ugliest order. In fact, the Supreme Court in Merchants Loan and Trust v. Simitaka in 1921 at 28, they say, in determining the definition of the word income thus arrived at, this court has consistently refused to enter into the refinements of lexicographers or economists and has approved in the definition quoted what it believed to be the commonly understood meaning of the term, which must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Sure. They totally understood what the people were thinking because of what these lexicographers had put out. A scale of understanding the lexicographer's power is called the Flesch Index. It's spelled F-L-E-S-C-H. And it is a measure of literacy, if you will, the understanding of the English language, particularly written English language. So just for giving you examples, the normal newspaper is written about 8.5. A first-year college student understands around 11. A law school graduate only comprehends at 15. The tax code in particular is written at the level of 35 with pieces as high as 55. Excuse me, at an average level of 33 with pieces as high as 55. If the newspaper is written at 8.5 and they're talking at 55, is there anybody beyond maybe 0.01% of the population of America that can understand what these clowns are talking about? No, obviously. So going back to the income tax, these lexicographers, and you know, I often say in articles that the lexicographer, the Supreme Court called lexicographers smarmy buggers in very lawyerly language. So I'll let you read up and decide how accurate I am. But as to the income tax, we the people, the Union state citizens, according to the Slaughterhouse Cases of 1872, and otherwise known as American nationals today, have been trained to ask who when thinking about an income tax. But the proper question must be what constitutes liability. For the Constitution of the United States designates two classes of taxation. They are direct, which is applied by apportionment, as well as indirect that are applied, that are required to be uniform throughout the Union States. The three categories of taxables are people, property, and activities. And I would ask again, if there's anybody out there that can think of another piece of that pie in existence, please let us know, because we have yet to be able to find it. The direct taxes are applied to people and property via census and enumeration. Indirect taxes and valuation, I might add. Indirect taxes are best described as an excise and are placed on activities. However, there must be some way devised to measure the activity. This has come down through time as calculating either the production of the activity or a flat fee on something necessary to the process. Now, the 16th Amendment is rather interesting. So we look at it and it says, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states, and without regard to any census or enumeration. So if we analyze that sentence, we note that they have the power to put taxes on incomes from whatever source derived. Well, that's very fine, but how does an income fall into the people, property, or activities? It doesn't, but it does fall into the measure. And the 16th Amendment was written in July of and passed off for ratification in July of 1909. Very soon after that, the first Revenue Act, with this newfound power that since the Congress passed it, they figured they could go ahead and write legislation with it, and they made a tax upon income, and they said specifically, this is an excise tax upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity. Well, a whole bunch of people got thought that that was not proper and not constitutional, so they got together and sued, and it made it to the Supreme Court in Flint v. Stone Tracy. And the court in Flint said, yes, this is a constitutional excise tax on a particular privilege. And working in the corporate capacity obviously is a privilege because you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get to do business under that name. And there are a lot of privileges which inure to being able to do business on that under that name. So the court says, yeah, this is a great tax. This is a great excise tax. And so this is, so we go back to the 16th Amendment. We can see that this is a power to lay an excise tax on incomes, but income is not an activity. So it must be a measure. That's the only two possibilities. And also, Congress is barred from anything that sustains the right to life, the right to property, and the right to use that property to enhance your life, otherwise the pursuit of happiness. So the court again said, this is great. This really works. And so that was handed down in 1911. From Flint at 551, we see the tax under consideration, as we have construed the statute, may be described as an excise upon a particular privilege of doing business in a corporate capacity, i.e., with the advantages which arise from corporate or quasi-corporate organization, or when applied to insurance companies for doing business of such companies. And at 152, it says, quote, if business is not done in the manner of the statute, no taxes payable, end quote. Also in that case, the court stated that a private firm is not subject to the income tax, nor are private individuals or private partnerships. Synonyms for not subject to are not liable for or immune. And here again, I want to say that the difference between immune and exempt in law is dramatic. An exemption means that legislatures lay out the who, what, where, and when of the tax. And those are three statements stating the subject of the tax, as in working in the corporate capacity, the measure of the tax, in that case, income, and a statement of liability. Who pays the tax? Who is responsible for the tax? And in this case, it was the officers of the corporation, because they are in control of the checkbook of the company and the policies that come and go. So that came down. Flint said, yeah, this is good. And the exemption part comes in where the legislators say, yes, this is the parameters of this tax, but in our largesse, we are going to exempt you from the penalty. Religious organizations, brotherhoods, certain farming organizations, all of these are in the tax laws of the early 1900s, 19-teens. Nonetheless, all of this goes through, and then Congress gets it back in their purview, and the 16th Amendment was supposedly ratified and pronounced ratified early in 1913. And then in October of 1913, the Revenue Act came out, and they said they got to drop excise, first of all. So the Congress said, we are applying this thing. We're going to call it the normal tax, and it is a tax upon income for 1%, and you have individuals that are liable, such as the lowercase c citizen of the United States, which was promulgated by the 14th Amendment, differentiating themselves from we the people, the Union state citizens, albeit now called American nationals. And that situation, it says, okay, we're applying this normal tax to our, as in D.C.'s citizens, lowercase c citizens of the United States. Because at that time, there were a great deal of black folk which had been freed from slavery and freed from the misapplication of the Dred Scott 1850-something decision, which, again, is stated in the Slaughterhouse cases where they make the differentiation between lowercase c citizens and Union State citizens. Having all said that, we now have this situation where where D.C. has said, yep, we're going to tax all of our citizens. And then they said, okay, and we're also going to tax corporations. And they withdrew the 1909 law. But they said in two different places. And first they said any party doing business as a partnership is not subject to this. However, the parties themselves are, if they are our citizens or residents in D.C. or any of these situations. And it's a long, convoluted thing that they write. Again, lexicographers applying their craft, if you will. So the 1913 came out in October. The 1913 revenue law came out in October. And then on the day before Christmas, they passed the Federal Reserve Act, which chartered a private bank that is owned by several people. Names you'll probably hear are Rothschild, Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, and so on. That ilk of bankers, if you will. So the Federal Reserve Charter, and the Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express. They just had to make it sound like it was part of the government. It is, in fact, a private bank. And it was given control over the currency. So with that, they produced what is now known as the fractional reserve banking system. So fast forward today, if you walk into a bank of whatever stripe, and hand them cash and tell the person behind the counter, put this in my account. They say, thank you very much. And they put it in their drawer. That cash is no longer yours. It is property of the bank. It goes on their asset column. What you have is a claim upon the cash. So we to understand that. Now, you've often heard the IRS says, you know, it goes in and seizes your bank accounts. No, what really happens is it goes into the bank and hands them a letter of levy and says that this human with this tax identification number owes us a debt. There is now a lien established in favor of the United States. And we understand that you have his rights to property, and we are staking a higher claim. And the bank goes, yeah, you're right, here you go, and hands their cash to this higher claim than you have, which is the IRS. So when you go back and you want to get your cash and you write an order for that cash, which would be a check, then they are bound to give it to you unless a higher claim has already been presented to them. And then they say, oh, there's nothing here. Your claim is moot because the account is empty. Diabolical, right? The other thing that you must understand about banks is that they do not loan out depositors' money, because the money is now theirs for to begin with, but they don't necessarily loan that out. What happens when you go in, and we'll use a housing mortgage as an example, what happens when you go down and get a loan on your home, and we'll use $100,000, and the bank says, okay, you are credit worthy. We will loan you this $100,000 and you're presented with two documents mainly, a mortgage and a note. And the note describes the amount loaned to you and the payment and the interest rate that will be charged and the payment back then. Okay. Once you sign that note, it becomes a negotiable instrument. The bank takes it and puts it in their asset column, just as they did your cash in our earlier example. They then create money out of thin air and into an account, so like a holding account, transfer the proper amount to this this moving account, and from that account cut checks to pay off the house mortgage and any liens and any workers and whatever else is part of the mortgage. The mortgage documents indebt you and enslave you or indenture you to paying off that thing. And the term mortgage means contract unto death. It's French. Anyway, the so the mortgage is, that's a contract. You're going to pay this amount of money to this end. At that point in time, the note will be satisfied, but during that time, they may sell the note, and the purchasers of the note may sell that note, and so on and so forth. And this brings us back to the toxic bundles of mortgage notes that caused the 2008 crash, if you will. So that's how the banks work. Oh, as part of, I believe, the Dodd-Frank stuff done back, the Dodd-Frank legislation done back in the 2008 arena, there were two main things that came out of it. One is that if you have a safety deposit box in a bank that you think is private and some emergency is declared, if you go down to the bank to get your stuff that you put in your safety deposit box, quote unquote, they must have a Department of Homeland Services personnel standing there with you when you open that box so he can examine the contents, make sure that the contents, and make sure that it's okay. Yeah, you don't have anything like excess cash, because you're not allowed to have excess cash, according to the purveyors, if you will. The other thing is this emergency, if the bank is suffering an emergency and it becomes insolvent, they are allowed to hand you bank stock in lieu of the cash that you handed them that you have a claim on. So they, and whatever the going rate of the stock is at that point will be measured out for the cash that was quote unquote in your account, and they'll hand you the pieces of paper, which may or may not be worth anything at that point. So that's a little bit, I went over that to dispel some of the misconceptions about how banks work and what they're really doing. And so you think that the Federal Reserve, that the Mint of the United States is churning out all of this money. That is absolutely dwarfed by the amount of money created in the Federal Reserve banking system. I mean, it's incredible. And we're talking in the neighborhood of quadrillion dollars. This is a quadrillion is 1,000 trillion. Lots and lots of zeros. So all that being said, we come down to what our company does for folks. And we create a private firm. The private firm is mentioned, as I said, in Flint v. Stone Tracy. That's where the term was coined for our purposes. And a private firm is indirectly mentioned in Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code of today. Internal Revenue Code, I think it was 1952, was designated from Title 26 of the United States Code. They said in some order, they said it shall now be known as the Internal Revenue Code. And at some future time, we can sit down over a cold libation and discuss the various lexicographers' initiations of how codes and statutes and laws differ from each other. But that's for another day. So our private firm, back to the code. So Section 701 of the code says, a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. Big thing, that period, because that simply says that chapter one, and it's chapter one, is that chapter, and where most income taxes are imposed. But here again, the income is simply the measure of the tax, not the not the subject of the tax. And so the limited liability company is the basis of our private firm, and we have found that New Mexico is the best one doing it, because on the in the state of New Mexico, when one goes to apply for a limited liability company organization, there are two parties on the form. They are the organizer and the registered agent. A registered agent's one job is to receive process in case the LLC is sued, and then he hands that, he signs it on it from to the process server, and then hands it off to the principal that he was, as he, who had contracted him to be the registered agent. Both the organizer in New Mexico, both the organizer and the registered agent can be other limited liability companies. That is huge. Somebody, I'm sure, got a whole lot of money to write this legislation that way, because typical politicians do not give away the farm. Because you can see how the one, and the organizer, if no other paperwork is filed, is considered to be the owner of the new LLC. So you can you see how this can be backstopped, for one LLC owns the other LLC, owns the third LLC, owns the fourth LLC, and so forth and so on. So if anybody tries to sue the first LLC, well, they've got to go and find the registered agent, which is another LLC. And then they have to get the paperwork redone and find the second registered agent, which is another LLC. And they got to go back and get the paperwork redone at the court. And then they got to go find, and you can see how, because lawyers don't like to work hard. So this is costing the quote unquote, plaintiff lots and lots of money with no possibility or very limited possibility of recouping these funds once they get through this. And this is totally by statutes. The other thing about New Mexico LLCs is they're exempt from reporting. Once established, and we always establish ours in perpetuity, once established, they never have to talk to anybody, according to the New Mexico statutes. Huge. So the our company goes down and gets as organizers, and then we have a sister company under our umbrella that acts as the registered agent. So everything done on the organizational level, which we received from the Secretary of State of New Mexico, an organization, a certificate of organization, that the they don't have to, the so such as places such as Nevada, Delaware, and possibly Wyoming, when you file for organization, you have to have names on it, and they keep that list private. But in New Mexico, there's no names, there's nothing to find. Because it's an LLC owned by an LLC owned by an LLC. Huge kind of privacy beyond measure, because there's nothing to find except in some paperwork in our safe and the client's safe. So we go down and we get the certificate of organization. Then we go and get a one of our personnel goes and gets a EIN, which stands for employer identification number, which is one of the various forms of one of the various forms of tax identification number. And when you go and look for an EIN for an LLC, it has five questions. as to why you're getting this this LLC or this EIN number. And they are: start a new business. I hired employees for banking purposes, which used to say for banking purposes only. Change type of organization, or purchased an active business. So the banking purposes, and this is what it says: select this option if the reason for applying for an EIN is strictly to satisfy banking requirements or local law. So 701 says a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed. The term partnership is defined way over in 7701A2, I believe, and which in part says the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. When you apply to get an LLC, you get a certificate of organization. So you can see how this is specifically say. So the 701 could say an LLC is not subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, right? So if it's not subject to, it is therefore immune. And when it's not subject to, it means that you don't have to keep receipts. You don't have to file anything with anybody because it's exempt from reporting as well. In other words, all business done under that umbrella of that LLC that our company creates, all business done under that is income tax free worldwide, period. That, my friends and neighbors, is huge. So back to our progression. We get the certificate of organization, that new company, and we'll use the moniker XYZ LLC. It now has a tax identification number. On the IRS paperwork, the person applying for this new EIN is listed as the sole member at that point. That sole member holds, once he receives the EIN, he holds a meeting of the company members, and they create a resolution commissioning some third party as a manager for the LLC. Way that the legislation is written, the XYZ LLC or whatever it's called can have as many managers as it wants. And so you can add things like chief manager or executive manager or whatever, but the true one only office of the LLC is manager. So then the new manager takes his commission, the EIN paperwork, and the certificate of organization, and goes to a local financial institution, a bank, if you will, and gets the new company a checking account that has a debit card and has electronic banking and has all these other things. They bring that back to our office, and our personnel will then put it all together, because money, obviously, if an account is established, money has to be placed in there. They move the money around, make sure all the bits and pieces work, and then they attach it to a cell phone. This is called a pay-as-you-go phone. And because here again, we're all about privacy and anonymity in our product. That personnel will get the cell phone rolling, make sure everything works, and you can access all the accounts and all the electronic banking. And we like to use Square and Cash App as well, for ease of money use in doing business and being able so the new company can take payments of its widgets or services with debit cards, credit cards, or checks. All that's put together, box it up, and ship it to the client. And because we have clients in a multiple of venues, everything from nurses to small manufacturers to truck drivers to musicians. So this works in all vehicles or in all venues because the vehicle is sound, the vehicle is private, and all business done under the vehicle is income tax free. Once the client gives it, they literally open the box up that this comes in and can commence to do business under that company name, income tax free worldwide. We also have ongoing services because what we build is called, it's a new business model. It is entirely independent of anybody else's circumstances. It is a new thing. So the client, whatever they do at that point, is their business model. We build this brand new great thing, ship it to them, and then we say, hey, now it's your business. We don't touch it. We give you a letter something like a non-disclosure agreement that says, hey, we built it, but we don't touch it anymore without written direction from you. And then so the client then takes it, and there's a time called integration where they take this brand new business model and integrate it into their present business model at whatever level that may be desired by them. And that falls under what we call our hotline services, which is free for the first year and then a subscription thereafter. So that's a background of why it works the way it works, a little bit about how it works, and the privacy and anonymity that are built into the product, because our company motto is, we strive to make you as successful as possible. And I am now open for questions.
All righty. Mr. Slevin, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Star 2, that's that little symbol underneath the number 7 on your dial pad. And that will pop up on my end, and I will unmute your phone so you can speak with Mr. Slevin here. Those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll notice to the center right of your monitor the frame of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click into that and type away your comment or question. Outside that rectangle is underneath is a place to put your name and other information if you like, and then hit submit. And I will be glad to give voice to your comment or your question. One thing I'd like to, hello Ron, I see you there, just to give me a second, we'll get to you, you're first. Mr. Slevin, your company has actually communicated directly with a quote, employee's, end quote, employer to assist in translating them from an employee to that company hiring an LLC. Would you like to speak a moment on that?
Sure. In the W-2 world, everything is contract. So the contract is between the employee, which is the defined term within the IRC, and employer, which is also defined. If you ever want to really interest yourself, go down to 7701, I believe it's section B or C, and it says the term employee includes for the purposes of, and then goes on a 109-word rant and comes up down and says the full-time life insurance salesman for the purposes of Chapter 21. And if you look at Chapter 21, the definition is the officer of a corporation. So which this, again, ties straight back to the 1909 initial post-16th Amendment income tax. Nonetheless, so the employee now has a contract with the employer to perform some service and for which he will receive a compensation. So, that's standard. There's all kinds of different portions of the compensation. But the main thing is it's always the W-2 involved, and the W-2 is known as a third-party reporting because in the IRS's eyes, you have they are the first party, you, the debtor, are the second party, and then the people that report on how much income that you had is known as the third party. So the W-2 is a third party reporting form, as is 1099s, 1098s, K-2s, and several other smaller ones. Nonetheless, the employee becomes educated about this thing called the burden rate, and it is the bottom line an employer pays for that employee's service. It is typically 1.5 to 1.6 times the salary of the employee. So just to use big round numbers, we'll say that the Joe is the employee and IBM is the employer. So IBM pays Joe to fix computers and he pays him $100,000 a year. So Joe becomes educated and acquires a private firm for his disposal. And he goes to IBM and says, hey, boss, how would you like to make a lot more money on my service? And, of course, boss goes, well, how would I do that? So, well, I know that you have to use this thing called the burden rate. And so you're right now, my salary is $100,000, and my cost to you is roughly $160,000. So what I'm proposing is, instead of being an employer to employee contract, we have an employer, which is an entity typically, going and contracting for another entity, which is Joe's LLC, and then the other entity represents Joe. So you get the same guy doing the same great job at the same place as before, except instead of $160,000 over a year, it's only going to cost you $120,000. So what that means to you, Mr. IBM, is you will cut one check per month for $10,000 and ship it to Joe's LLC, and that's it. And then at the end of the year, then you'll write a 1099, and it'll have Joe's LLC's tax identification number on it, and it will get shipped to the IRS, and it will get shipped back to, you know, to Joe's LLC's office. And literally, because of Section 701, when the IRS gets that 1099, they go, oh, that's nice, and they throw it in the trash, because they know that the LLC is not subject to the income tax. So all, quote unquote, income generated or propagated there is moot, and they throw it away because they have no place to settle it with. So Joe is now still doing exactly the same job, reporting to the same people with the same everything, and Joe's LLC is profiting $120,000, which is now the cost to IBM versus $160,000, and what's that, about a 35% decrease in expenses? So
savings, yeah.
Why wouldn't Mr. IBM want to do that?
Right, so that's the basis. The 1099 goes out to the IRS from also the employer is also notifying the IRS. So
yeah, that's where 1099s go. They go to the – go ahead.
Right.
So the IRS, after a year or two, writes the LLC and says, where is your tax for whatever year? Is that coming to your offices for you to respond to, or is that coming to your students' post location?
Neither. First of all, no. The in our example, Joe's LLC has a local office, probably someplace close to Joe's house. But one of the rules of security is you don't have your mail delivered where you sleep. So we recommend getting something like a UPS box. A PO box is not recommended because of the federal implications, but UPS and other mailbox suppliers, this very does well. And that becomes the mailing address of Joe's LLC. So if the federal government were to write to Joe's LLC, they would use that address, because that address is also on the W-9, which Joe's LLC signs and submits to, in our example, IBM, so that their paperwork is satisfied and their HR department is happy. But the IRS is fully aware of Section 701 and how an LLC is not subject to the income tax in the first place. So in the nearly 20 years of doing this, the IRS has never written any of the LLCs that our company has organized, because they know they're not subject to it. And some of these
1099s, in response to the 1099s, the IRS has never written your people.
Exactly.
Because how many years?
Nearly 20.
Wow.
And some of these clients have run in excess of $2 million through our private firms in any given year. And then it graduates down from there. So we're talking very attractive. Well, if you look at the purview of IRS investigators, more than a couple million going through in one tax year is very, shall we say, enticing. And so if there was a way that they could figure out how to address these LLCs, I'm sure they would have figured it out by now, but they don't. Mm-hmm. And the only reason they don't is because they can't.
Okay.
So does that answer your question?
Talking about the, Yes, sir. You were talking about the W-9s. People who have corrected their status that currently hold the title of employee have been encouraged to or have been made aware of the W-8-BEN form that exists and are offered to use a older W-8-BEN form that identifies as the entity individual that is not subject. It's got a whole list of different things, but the last, very last one says Union State Citizen. Mm-hmm. This is an older form, but it's, you know, it's just like mm-hmm. Black's Law Dictionary. You may be on the 13th edition today, but Black's Law 4th still works just as well, if not better, because the definitions are more clear. Likewise, again, older forms are just fine as well.
They tell the truth.
Do you have, pardon me?
They tell the truth.
Yeah. So the question is that would these people be working instead of with a W-9, working with a W-8-BEN?
Here again, the quote-unquote employer-employee contract, which is typically reported on the W-2, is just that. Mm-hmm. It's a contract. So our way of doing things substitutes in from the employee to an employer, the employer to another entity. So it absolutely removes the quote-unquote employee from any possibility of being shown to receive income. Okay. The change of status, that's a different contract. I am not familiar with that. I just know that our way of doing it totally eliminates the employer-employee relationship. So it can be said that what the way of doing business under our product is makes the human invisible to the IRS, which is really a good place to be. What else?
Correct. We're going to go to Ron now in Florida. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes, I timed in just as you were giving the price. What is the cost of your program?
There's two prices, Ron. Operating under what Mr. Slevin operates through is $7,500. I am pleading with the people to consider, instead of creating the LLC in the direct manner that it is, to have the LLC created by two charitable religious trusts. And in doing so, you're adding an extra layer, if you would, in addition. I spoke earlier in the call, at the beginning of the call, that I am a believer in overkill. And to that end, to me, the perfect arrangement is what Mr. Slevin is offering, added with two charitable religious trusts, to where the man or woman, as trustee for those charitable religious trusts, have corrected their status. I mean, that's three layers of "You Can't Touch This" by MC Hammer.
And the price of those is an extra $2,000?
Yeah, it's $1,000 for each trust, so it's an extra $2,000 if they want to go that way. They can come in directly with your product. $7,500, fine, that's it. I just want them to hear what I would suggest that I would do where I similarly situated myself, and also, you know, on top of that, correcting your status so that you have every single advantage three times. Where you're not taxable. You're not taxable through what you offer, what Mr. Slevin offers in his LLC. The two charitable religious trusts are deemed by the IRS as, quote, non-taxpayer, end quote. That's a legal term, just like the term employer is a legal term. And then, of course, being having corrected your status from a United States citizen to a Union State citizen, otherwise known as an American national, in Title 8 of the U.S. Code, that's three times you can't touch this. And okay,
if I already have two trusts already established.
Are they charitable religious trusts?
Yes.
Then, and are they currently holding anything? Doing anything?
They're holding currency.
I would never commingle myself. I would never commingle anything that is involved with charitable religious trusts. Insulate and isolate. One trust, one item. Now, if you have the only exception to that is if you have items that are not able to generate a potential liability. Obviously, an automobile can generate a liability. A motorcycle, an airplane, ski boat, whatever. All of those can generate. Your front steps, your pool, the apron around your pool and your pool can create a liability. Everything would go into its own individual separate trust, one item. But gold bars, your stamp collection, your numismatic collection, the 300-year-old painting by Renoir or whoever it was popular back then, hanging on the wall that's been in your family for 300 years, that would be, all of that can go into one trust because they unto themselves can never generate a liability. So in applying for this, I would be doing it with two new blank charitable religious trusts, creating the LLC, and then move from there.
Okay. But can I use my existing charitable religious trust temporarily and
yes.
Transferring that to two new trusts once the event occurs?
I believe you can. That's going to be a question for Bernie. I believe he built his trusts, the CRTs, to enable you to trade with them. I believe so.
Okay. And yeah, so one thing you might think of, if I may, one thing that you might think of our private firms as it's probably best described as a commercial interface. Because of its lack of liability in the income tax arena, it is an interface of the commercial nature between the client, the trust that the client has had built, or any other functional entity or whatever you may come up with. But because it's so standard business practices, because everybody in the business world understands an LLC and how it works, and so everything that we do, it uses standard business practices explicitly by the statute of the various jurisdictions in which we operate. So the word interface helps between the trust or the human or whatever. So it interfaces with commerce, income tax free. That's just a little different way of thinking about it. Go ahead.
Okay, so that's $2,000 for the
It's $7,500 for Mr. Slevin's project.
For the
and
private firm.
You can stop there if you want. I'm taking it an extra step, and I'm having two charitable religious trusts come in to create the LLC.
Okay, that would be a total of $9,500 utilizing the trust.
Yep.
Okay, that's what I was trying to determine. All right. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Good talking to you again, Ron. Anyone else? Press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand. We don't want to have an early call tonight. Press *2. Let me go check Freedom's Radio. We'll go next to Ronald in California. Go ahead, Ronald.
Yes, I have a question about JW recordings. And I went to the website and I looked up on Mondays and they're not speaking about JW.
Correct
my status. Is there any recordings for him?
I had a conversation. Yes, there are. We have them all secured. There is a, as you know, we had ransomware 7-8 months ago. I spoke with the new programmer that we have this morning. He's now aware of this, and he is going back to relink those into proper assignments so that Monday is Monday, Tuesday is Tuesday, tonight's Wednesday is Wednesday, et cetera. They were, frankly, all over the place. I was shocked when I found that out the other day. So we're getting that fixed.
Okay, because I was trying to get some, you know, do a little more in-depth study on that.
Okay, Ronald, do you have my direct email?
I don't. I don't think so.
Okay, do you have my direct cell number?
I believe, yeah, I have that 800 number, yeah.
Okay, call the 800 number, and very slowly and clearly and distinctly leave your full name, your email address, and your phone number, and I will go grab the recording from Monday night, which I have in the database, and I will just send that directly to you. How about that?
Okay. Thank you. That's very appreciative. Thank you.
Sure. It's my pleasure. All right. Next is Jennifer Sue. Go ahead. Oh, Ronald, was there any other questions?
No, that's it. I'm just trying to correct my status first. Yeah.
All right. That's good. All right. Thank you. Jennifer Sue, go ahead.
Hey, gentlemen. Do the corporation's soul have come into play at all with this system?
No. Well, if you say you're going to a commercial interface, as I like that term from Mr. Slevin. So you're going to do a commercial interface, and you're going to initiate that with two charitable religious trusts, having 50% shares each in the LLC. Then one day, the corporation's soul creates the Private Interest Foundation in Panama. Private Interest Foundation in Panama creates three foreign grantor trusts in a country like Belize that says, hey, we don't care what you do outside of our country. It's none of our business. We don't care if you make billions of dollars. It's none of our affair. We're only interested in what you do inside of our country. So a parent foreign grantor trust is created. That foreign grantor trust parent creates two children. I refer just to make things easy, boy foreign grantor trust and girl foreign grantor trust. Those two foreign grantor trusts then would communicate to each of the respective charitable religious trusts that are already existing now. Maybe it ran for 3 years that way, and buys them out, makes a transfer, so that what was the CRTs having 50% share apiece into the commercial interface that Mr. Slevin offers is now being replaced or transferred to the two foreign grantor trusts. So, yes, it does work into it. Well, the reason that I'm excited about what Mr. Slevin offers is because instead of having to bring someone in at $35,000 to do it, quote, right, end quote, we can effectively do the same thing for $7,500 or $9,500 and have it in place and let it operate for as long as you need to prior to doing the corporation sold, the Private Interest Foundation, and the three foreign grantor trusts.
Who's the trustee of the charitable trusts because my corporation's
In your instance, yeah, you already have a corporation soul. So your corporation soul would be the trustee.
Of the
trust.
Yeah. Okay. And who runs the LLCs again? Who's I do as me or as the corporation soul or as the trust?
As
well,
the
there's several titles. There's several titles and layers in it, but it all comes down to you're the one pushing the buttons and making the decisions.
Correct.
But nobody in the public world knows that or can find that out unless they break into your safe or our safe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you, Ms. Jennifer. All right. Next is Norm, then Nancy, then Ron. Go ahead, Norm.
Okay. I've been listening for a while, and you made the change from a one grantor trust to using two CRT. What difference does that make to me in operation?
It's additional layers of protection. No, on I hate to use the expression, on the cheap. All right, you can afford to come in with Mr. Slevin's commercial interface for $7,500. You can add an additional layer of insulation by having two CRTs, each having 50% interest in the LLC. And then sometime later, a boy grantor trust and a girl grantor trust replace the CRT. Now you have an additional third layer of protection. And all of that ultimately comes back to the corporation sold. You're controlling everything. You've never lost your hands on the reins. You've never lost control. But you've added additional layers of non-taxable operations, additional protections, additional shields, whatever you want to call it. And, of course, ultimately, you'll correct your status, and you'll go from being a United States citizen to an American national, and that's the last of what you can do. So that gives you four layers of you can't touch this.
Okay.
The CRT.
Yes.
The FGTs, the corporation sole, and then finally your status as an American national.
Okay, so I'm doing the same thing that I would have spent $35,000 for before you introduced this gentleman tonight, which now I'm going to spend $7,500 for the same thing. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. It's close, but it's not correct. $7,500 is Mr. Slevin's offer, standalone, in getting the LLC. And you are the pass-through to that LLC. We can add layers of protection. The CRT is a non-taxpayer by the IRS. The Foreign Grantor Trust is a non-taxpayer according to belief, because they don't care what you do outside the country. The corporation sole is a non-taxpayer, as are the CRTs. The Private Interest Foundation is a non-taxpayer. And you, once you have corrected your status, is absolutely outside of the jurisdiction of being a taxpayer. So that's what I mean by overkill. I'm not trying to sell anybody at this time anything other than protect yourself. And as many layers of protection that you can put on yourself, is you're better off.
Okay, and something else I've discussed with you before, maybe you or the gentleman on the call have a comment. I'm going to have an LLC. Okay, now in the LLC, I'm going to add the pilot training company, which could be a fairly large operation. I mentioned doing a C corporation, and before you said, no, don't do that.
Right.
Do something else. What did you suggest?
The LLC. No matter what commercial
so
you have you're
LLC
thinking of doing.
Embedded into another LLC.
No. No matter
well,
what.
If I might.
Please, go ahead, Mr. Slevin.
Yeah, so our product produces an LLC that can't be tied back to you, the client, right? Whatever that you decide to move into it, of whatever size, it doesn't matter, because the LLC itself is built in perpetuity, and it appears to be owned by another LLC on the public record, which appears to be owned by another LLC, and so on, because that's the way the statutes are written. So you could acquire our product and move in whatever size organization under its umbrella that you wish. But as Michael talks about, then there's other layers that can be used. But you could use it at your present time as a commercial interface for whatever size commerce that you're doing. But, you know, it is always recommended you have more than one layer. So that's what Michael's trying to explain. But yes, you can do everything at the first level, which is $7,500. However, it is advisable that more protection would be laid in. Any other questions?
Let me explain a little bit what I'm trying to do. The LLC, the primary LLC, is going to partner with another person, I'll create another company. It's a flight training company, which could be into the millions, because we're going to own full motion simulators for Airbus and 747, maybe. And we
that's
want,
great.
He and I are 50-50 yep. partners. And that's got to be embedded into the LLC. So what entity
yep.
do I use for that organization?
The difficulty with you and or your partner filing the paperwork to get an LLC is it puts a paper trail on your name and numbers, for lack of a better term. So the way our product works, that doesn't exist, but once it's formed, then you can move anything into it you wanted to. And if you want to talk size, Daimler Chrysler is a limited liability company, and you know how big they are. So your flight simulator training business could be brought in under one of our private firms with little or no fuss and muss. And because it's not connected to you in any way on the public record, then you are shielded from any tax liability that somebody could dream up, which, because it's not subject to the income tax, there isn't one. Did that answer your question?
Sort of. One more twist I'll throw in. The primary LLC, which we'll call it Norman's LLC, that's the number one, is going to have other entities in it that are operating companies in addition to the pilot
yeah.
training company.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So are each one of those an LLC?
They can be, yeah.
So that's an LLC embedded?
Well, embedded is not a proper technological or terminology for this kind of business structures. So you have the business structure itself, and it's owned by members. Those members can be human beings, entities, or whatever, trust or anything else, okay? So, and they own percentages of membership. The way ours works is that percentages of membership is not on the public record. So you have one LLC that's producing the flight simulators. You have another LLC that's marketing those. You have a third LLC that does the contracting for the students for the flight simulators. These are all owned by the members, and they have managers as officers. So, but the way that our structures work, that membership is entirely private, because it's not required to be registered by the Secretary of State of New Mexico, then it doesn't exist in the public record. Does that make more sense?
Sort of. The LLC, I think, that Bernie does is either in Wyoming or Montana. So yours is in New Mexico,
no, sir,
is that right?
No, sir, it's not.
It's not what?
You've got feedback coming in, Norman. Would you turn off your speakerphone, please?
Yeah, I just picked up the headset. Oh.
Much better.
Much better.
Okay, so, all right. Anyway, I'll leave it with that. A lot of information there. I have to digest myself, what you said. But it sounds like LLC for each.
If I might, the great way of the way our company does it is all of the stuff that you were talking about is details. So once we get in touch with each other, then we can work all those details out to your best satisfaction and your best success. But trying to answer, you know, those kind of details on an open call like this is problematic, as you can see. So that would be my suggestion was, okay.
Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Appreciate the info.
Thank you. Thank you, Norman. Next is Nancy, followed by Ron. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi, this is my first time on the call, and I'm just trying to digest what's going on here. But is this formation for running a business enterprise, which the corporation soul and the charitable religious trust could not do?
Charitable religious trusts and corporation souls are non-commercial entities. They cannot run a business. This LLC that Mr. Slevin offers can run the business. And all I'm recommending.
Go ahead.
Mr. Slevin's interface is the business arrangement, if he would, the vehicle that you would operate through. $7,500 and you're done. Michael Edward is stepping up the game by having, instead of himself being the participant, being the driving force in the creating of this LLC, Michael Edward would have two charitable religious trusts, CRTs, be the driving force at having 50% share apiece in the creation of this LLC that Mr. Slevin is operating, because the CRTs are deemed non-taxpayers. So there's one level. And then sometime down the road, when my business is making money that I can really afford to dive things, then a corporation soul would be created to create the Private Interest Foundation in Panama that would create a three foreign grantor trusts in Belize, which is a country that says, we don't care how much money you make outside of our country. We have no interest in it. It's non-taxable. And then those two of those foreign grantor trusts would then buy out or be gifted, whatever, the CRTs that are presently existing as the controllers or having 50% shares of that LLC that you've been operating now for 3 or 4 years, hypothetically. All that being layer upon layer upon layer of entities that are not taxable. So instead of Mr. Slevin's, you know, one encompassed entity that's not taxable, which is sufficient unto itself, I'm going to have like five layers.
What are the other two? Four and five.
Other two what?
Layers.
Well, the last thing is, of course, the anchor to it all is the fact that Michael Edward is a union state citizen, an American national, which is also outside of the jurisdiction of the courts.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. That was a good rundown.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll digest that. I don't understand what the private interest trusts are.
Well, that's really, those are Saturday. Those are calls on questions for the Saturday call with Justice Beshear.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you. And
that's all I have. So that we have no misunderstanding, Mr. Slevin's offer is standalone. The fact that I want to come up behind it and do these things is because I just believe in overkill. That's all.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm familiar with the New Mexico LLCs, but I'm glad to see hear all the rest of you know, how this is operating in conjunction with the charitable religious trust and the private formation company that you said. So anyway, well, yeah, this is all very interesting, and thank you, and good night.
Thank you, Nancy. All right. Now, last is Ron. You're the anchor here, Ron. Take us home.
Yes, the LLC. How does it do banking, and can it do offshore banking?
Yes. an LLC is a standard business entity. They were first legislated in 1977 as a blending of the corporations that have been around for millennia and the quote unquote partnerships, which have general partners and limited partners. So the legislators got together, put those two things, and said, okay, now we're going to call this a limited liability company. And they specifically changed the language so that the officers are only managers, and that the membership is what owns the limited liability company. So as I explained earlier, our company goes out and does everything. We get it organized. We get it an EIN. We get it a checking account. So that's how it does business, through that checking account and or savings account, and or there's other accounts available as well. So that's how it does business. And so it is self-encompassing, standalone. It is not connected to anybody other than our company and its personnel, which are on the various pieces of paperwork that have to be filed. So once that is placed in the client's hands, and the client can do business under that umbrella and be virtually invisible because the business is not subject to the income tax. So that's our product, the private firm, in a nutshell. So what was the second half of your question?
Yeah, basically that's it. The LLC can open up an Austrian bank account.
Yes.
Very interesting. That's a viable alternative or parallel channel to the private interest and the foundations.
And the great thing about the great thing about LLCs is everybody understands that. You know, if you go into a bank, say, hey, I have a trust and this trust wants to open this, some of the banks will go, what? And, you know, using that as an example. But everybody in the business world understands LLCs. They understand how they work. They understand the situation, and they're used to dealing with them because it's a standard business practice. So that's the nice thing about. And that's why we call our product, the private firm, is a commercial interface, because whatever trust and or other entity situations that you've decided will best protect your estate, for lack of a better term, this is an interface that the business world understands and can deal with efficiently.
Okay. Now, second question. Should an individual have a convoluted business transactions for, you know, can they contact you and have a sit down and detail their interests and work with you to finalize their business plans?
Yes. And Michael would take care of that introduction.
Okay. That will help Norman's position. Thank you very much.
The key to understand is that this is all turnkey. There's all the work is done for you. You just have to fill in the slots. What's the name? What name do you want to use? Things like that. Everything else will be done for you. All righty? I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. You had some great questions. And I appreciate the enthusiasm. I want to thank Mr. Slevin for his great presentation tonight. It was enjoyable. And I look forward to seeing him again next week. I look forward to hearing from you privately, directly, about possibly moving forward and creating LLCs for your commercial efforts. And that would be about it. Again, thank you, Mr. Slevin. And until next week, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.